Okay, I'm going to pray again for us, and then we'll jump in. Heavenly Father, I thank you again for just this opportunity to fellowship with sisters who love you. I pray that you would just continue to be glorified in our midst this evening. I pray that as we look at the life of a faithful woman who just strove in her life hard after you, I pray that you would bless our time, that our conversation would just be honoring to you, and I pray that I would do an appropriate job of honoring her life. And I ask these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, so this is Lilias Trotter. The women's leadership team asked me to do a biography, and initially... Oh, yeah, those are handouts, but those aren't... You aren't going to need them until the end anyway, but that's okay. So they asked me to do a biography, and they had a couple of suggestions, and they said, or you can pick someone, and I am a very indecisive person, if you know me, like incredibly indecisive person. And I had a long list that I went through, and I texted a lot of people, and I was like, which one should I do? Do you have any recommendations? I asked, like, a slew of people. Several of you, people from other walks of life, that love Jesus, but different walks of life. Anyway, so I have a long list of biographies, so if you're ever interested in finding, you know, and learning more about women of faith in church history and our... in the Christian church, I'm happy to give you that list because it's very long. And then it was at the very end of my search that this person's name came across my radar or my screen, if I'm being honest, because that's where I was getting a lot of the ideas. So I was, you know, looking on my phone. So, but her name came across my screen. I had never heard of her. And I am just curious if any of you coming into tonight had heard of her before. If you'd heard of her before, would you raise your hand? Okay, so very few, and that is part of the reason why I ended up choosing her. So we have been reading through the book Humble Roots. I think probably the majority of you guys are part of that study, and talked a lot about humility and dying to ourselves, and she really exemplified that in her life. One of the biggest themes throughout her life was that she made a pretty big choice at the beginning of her ministry. To walk away from the opportunity to be famous and really world-renowned, for particularly for her art. She was very artistic. And she chose a life of pretty much obscurity instead. And the only reason that we know of her now is because there were a few faithful saints that pieced together her life. A lot of the books about her are out of print. A lot of her manuscripts are out of print. You can find some of them if you look online, but you have to kind of do a lot of heavy searching to find them. And they're really amazing that we have the information that we do now. Just based on some of the work that one woman in particular did to kind of restore her story for us. This is the biography that I had read. It's called A Passion for the Impossible. And there are a couple other books about her, and I have that list too for you guys if you're interested about it. So she was born in 1853, right at the kind of the height of the Victorian era in England. She was born into a very prestigious family, very wealthy family. She had a lot of servants. Made me think of Downton Abbey when I was reading about her, except about 100 years before Downton Abbey. So she would wake up to a servant bringing her a cup of tea. She never had to clean anything a day in her life up until the point that she left to be a missionary in Africa. But that was how she was raised. So she had all of the schooling at her fingertips, all of the... She lived the high society life, and so did her family. She was born to Isabella Trotter, and that is actually her first name is Isabella. She just goes by Lilias or Lily. That's how I'll refer to her when I'm talking about her. But she was born to Isabella and Alex Trotter, and when she was very young, her mom recognized a pretty exceptional artistic ability that she had. And as I was reading about this, it struck me that parents don't change throughout history, right? We see the things in our kids and we're like, oh, they're really artistic. Oh, they're not. Or, oh, this person's really athletic and this person's really not. And she really saw that her daughter had this exceptional eye, and she could see things differently than most other people could see things. Particularly in nature, she didn't have any classes or any formal training in art, but she just kind of picked up a paintbrush, and she could create pictures that from just looking at nature, specifically nature. And so she, like a good mother, got her a sketchbook, because that's what you do if you see something in your children that should be fostered and you want to encourage. And so she bought her her first sketchbook when she was young, so that she could kind of record some of her journeys with her parents, because they didn't have to work, because they just had money. They were a family of means, and so they would travel a lot. And so they, on all of her trips that she would take over the summers, she would keep diaries or a sketchbook of her experiences. And that kind of marked her life too. And some of the diaries that were found of hers, the collection of diaries she kept for about 40 solid years of ministry, almost daily. And the diaries themselves were text intermingled with watercolors and all of these pictures of her ministry, of where she was ministering, particularly in Africa. And so a lot of desert pictures, just really pretty paintings and things like that. So I have some of those to show you too. So you guys can kind of get an idea of how she thought, maybe, hopefully. Okay, so she was recognized pretty early that she was very artistic. Her mom saw that in her. It was right around 12 years old that things really changed for her when her father passed away. 12 years old, very important time in a kid's life. I think I was sharing with our small group a couple weeks ago, between the time between 8 and 12 years old, if something traumatic happens to you, science is now showing that it's very hard to move past that if something happens in that period or season of your life. It's just very influential on the rest of, very impactful. Not that other times it's not just as tragic, it is, but that just it tends to very much shape how you view your childhood or how you remember your childhood. And that was true for her. It was the time when she came to know the Lord, right after that. And people that observed her life up to that point said that there was a marked change and a marked difference in her life, which is, again, a sign of following Jesus and coming to know Jesus. There was a change in her, even just at 12, where she became much more empathetic towards other people, could see people and listened well to people, and she became marked by love, which I guess is supposed to mark the brethren. The love of the brethren is supposed to mark the believer, and she had that at a very young age, and was very passionate about loving others. And just had a unique ability to see people's needs, and she would meet those needs even as a child. And so, and adults recognized that in her, and they would write about it. So the person that put together this biography and was trying to figure out about this woman that she'd heard about, and there were no books written about her, just thought it was really interesting that all these other people had made comments, or you would find her name in different stories or different books that other people would write about her. That she was particularly loving, that she was marked by that for even before she went to any formal ministry, which I think is noteworthy of her. So some of her contemporaries were Amy Carmichael, so she kept quite a bit of correspondence with her. She was one that we did a biography on last year, 2 years ago. I don't really remember. And Elizabeth Elliot actually wrote a book based on one of her devotionals. And that was another reason why I chose her too. I thought, well, that's a pretty solid recommendation. Elizabeth Elliot's pretty solid. So anyway, so very worthwhile kind of reading about her life. She had a great appreciation for nature. And so most of her artwork is going to be of landscapes and things like that, which is particularly important because she ends up moving to the Sahara Desert, which I honestly I don't really care to go to the desert, honestly. But after seeing paintings of the desert and reading about it and reading, her writing about it, it's really compelling. It made me kind of want to visit the Sahara Desert all of a sudden. Maybe a little bit. It said that when she first saw the Alps, she was brought to tears and she cried, and she was a teenager at the time. And not everyone really has that necessarily that reaction to seeing nature. So So after her father passed away, it was just her and her mom. She had several other siblings, but she was one of the youngest, and so she was in the home a bit longer. She would travel a lot with her mom. She was one of the youngest. She would travel a lot with her mom, and they would go to lots of fun places. And in one such place, they were in Venice. They found themselves in Venice, which would be pretty great to just find yourself in Venice, but that's how it was described in the biography. And they were staying at a pretty fancy hotel, and they realized, or her mother realized, that someone else was staying there too. His name was John Ruskin, and he was a very influential thinker, artist, person, really very well-known around the world at the time and now. He's said to have influenced pretty much everyone in the 20th and 21st century, just based on his ideas, how well-respected he was. He was an art critic. If you wanted to have any influence in the world of art, he would know your name. You would want him to know your, you know, you would want to know him, those, that kind of thing. So he was a pretty, he was a famous individual. And Isabella, her mom, realized that they were at the same hotel, staying at the same hotel as this man. And she did something, and she wrote a letter to him and had it, like, the front desk guy. It didn't say it was the front desk guy, but maybe the bellhop or whatever, however that worked at the hotel. She brought him a letter saying, "Hey, I have a daughter. She is exceptionally talented and gifted at art. Would you take a look at her art? Would you take a look at some of her pieces, some of her watercolors?" Hoping that he would take a look at them, maybe to just give her an, you know, encourage her in that direction. Or I don't, some of the commentary on this event suggests that she really didn't expect much from him. He wasn't necessarily known as a really, really nice guy. And so art critics typically aren't, I don't think. Most critics aren't, hence the name critic. So she took a chance and she wrote a letter. It also made me think about how that's parents, that's what we do, right? We want people to notice our kids and how wonderful they are at certain things, and maybe manipulate even the school systems to let them in to college or something like that. I just thought it was interesting. It just doesn't change, you know, like we don't change. And so she wrote this letter, and he surprisingly said yes. And sorry, I just noticed Beth looking at something. I don't know what it was. Maybe the rose that they gave me up here. They said it's not to be confused with The Bachelor. So, anyway, so he said yes, and she sent up to his room, or however, wherever he was at in this hotel, sent to his room this portfolio of her piece of her art to him, and he was astounded by her talent and how exceptionally gifted she was. He actually had the opinion that women could not paint. And that was pretty well known. I don't know if Isabella knew that was his opinion, but he was pretty well known that he did not think that women could paint or really produce any sort of worthwhile pieces of artwork at the time. And he changed his stance and said that not only can women paint, but they can paint well, and maybe they're the only ones that can, based on what he saw of hers. That was a paraphrase, by the way. I did not memorize what he said. I'm sure it was much more articulate than that, and it was. And it's in there, and I have it highlighted, but I didn't mark it well enough to be able to flip to it. So he was very impressed, and he wanted to meet her immediately. And so they met there, and he was probably 57 at the time. I think it was about in his late 50s. And he had a habit of meeting young girls like her. She was 23, I think, at the time, and being very interested in them, not necessarily romantically, but sort of grooming them into being his pupils, so to speak. He had one previously who had passed away just before he met Isabella and Lilius. So it was kind of perfect timing, I guess, for him to take on a new mentee. And it wasn't just women, but it did make a note that there were several notes about how he took interest in young women, which would not be surprising. It does not say he was a believer. So I don't know that that would be necessarily strange for him to do that. So he kind of took her under his wing at that point and offered to provide some training for her, suggesting that if she had some training, she could be even more than exceptional. And so she started to take some lessons from him. now I'm thinking that over there is maybe not the best place for the laptop jam. It's not a big deal. She would go and visit his home. He had a very large estate, and she would go visit his home, and there were lots of pictures of this large turret room that she would have. She would wake up, and she would see the mountains in the background, and it showed a lot of the watercolors that she would do just after staying in his home there. I'll show you a little bit of what her... So that was his house. That was just part of his house, though. I don't know that I have another one of the rest of his house, but it, like, goes over here. And when she would look out, that's what she would be able to see. And that was kind of what she studied under for the short time that she did. While she was learning from him was when she really developed a heart for the poor in London. And she started working with the YWCA. That was when it first started. And she was very involved with it. She had a real heart for the working class woman. So she, again, was from, she was very well off, so she did not have to work, and it would have been very unsuitable for her to work at all. And so she spent her life devoted to serving those that were working. And she, again, she had this unique ability to see a need, and she would meet the need. And one of the needs that she saw that these women had that were working every day is that they did not have anywhere to eat lunch during the day. They would have to eat on the streets. And she didn't think that was good. And so she opened a restaurant for women. It was only for women, and opened a restaurant in London, hired people to work in it, and then passed that ministry off to someone else. Basically started it and then kind of passed it off so that the women would have a place to eat. Either they'd pay for it, or they would bring their sack lunch and they would eat in the restaurant. Simple way to minister to them. And then her real ministry around the same time was at night to the prostitutes that would roam the streets of London. And she was a single woman. And I was actually, Sean had asked who we were talking about tonight. And I said, I was kind of explaining who she was. And I wasn't necessarily going to talk about this, but throughout her life, she asked, was she single her whole life? And she was. She was single her whole life. And in her diaries and all the things that we have about her, and she was, again, meticulous about recording things that happened to her. There was no reference to marriage or children as though she was lacking anything. It was not necessarily a hope that she had or a hope that she had lost or anything like that. Just wasn't really addressed. It was suggested that maybe she had a relationship with John Ruskin. It was just kind of unknown. If they did, it wasn't a very intimate physical one because they were on different sides of the world and different on many occasions. But it was just suggested that maybe that was the case. But they had it's always said that they had a deep friendship. But I thought that was noteworthy just because she didn't necessarily even show an inclination to want to be married or have children. So she would roam the streets of London at night, and she would find women, and she would bring them back to her home to either just give them a night off the street, encouraging them to not, you know, work that night, or she would provide them a way to learn another skill, another trade, so that they would not have to do that as their job anymore. And she just had a lot of compassion for those women, and so she kind of created a ministry doing that. All the while also kind of studying under this man who, again, was profoundly gifted as well, and he basically controlled the art world for anyone that wanted to get into it, or his opinion mattered to everyone. And he started using her sketches of different places to teach his students. He would say, draw like this, you know. And he would often not even say that it was a woman that painted them or that drew them. Just do it like this because this is perfect, you know. And it was, again, it would, outside of any training that she had had. It was just God-given talent and a gift. And he noticed that while she was ministering in London that she wasn't giving enough time to her art. And he was noticing that it wasn't as good as maybe it was the first time that he saw it, or that it was not progressing at the rate that he thought it should. And so he came to her and would joke about, why are you helping all these poor people? They don't need your help. The world needs your art, essentially, is what he suggested, which sounds ridiculous to us as believers, but to someone who that if she's so given or gifted at this, was tempting, I think, to her. And it was at that point that he suggested that she, let's see, this is some of her paintings, which are just really pretty. That was after she ended up in North Africa, which we'll get to. We're not quite there yet, but I'm trying to think. Oh, this is John Ruskin. It's a painting that she did of him before he was older, I guess, before he was gray. But he doesn't look like a nice guy. I hadn't really thought about it until now. Looks very serious. Anyway, but he essentially encouraged her to stop all of the work that she was doing within her community to pursue her art more than she was. I'm going to sit down again just because there's mostly just paintings to show you guys, which I will do, but make sure I don't miss anything. Okay, so in May of 1879 is when he made her this offer. And it's, I call it the offer because in all of the writings about her, it's considered this major choice that she had to make, which kind of marked her life and is kind of her legacy that she left to us. And he told her that she could be immortalized if she would pursue her art as maybe the most important endeavor that she could undertake in her life. She could be immortalized, that she could be the most famous painter in the world. And he wasn't exaggerating. He wasn't one to exaggerate, but it was very serious. If you take this seriously and you, then you could be immortalized. You could be known forever, at least in this time, for this gift that you have. But you have to give your life to it. You have to give yourself to it. And she really struggled with that, idea. She was really conflicted, had a real crisis of faith, tugging one way or the other. And I don't know about you, but I hear that and I think, well, why couldn't she just do both? Because we know plenty of people that give themselves to, you know, the gifts that God has given them, and they're able to minister and preach the gospel even through it and using it. And she would say as much as well, that that this is not a prescriptive decision that she made. She wouldn't say that every believer, every follower of Christ should do this thing that she did. But she felt very strongly that she could not serve two masters, so to speak, and that she could not seek God's kingdom and his righteousness and pursue art the way that Ruskin wanted her to. And so she said no. And he was very disappointed. But they maintained a friendship, and he still, when as she could, she would, you know, send him pieces, send him paintings, send him drawings, those kinds of things. But kind of at that point said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to pursue this ministry that God seems to have given me here instead. And so that's what she did. And she did it full force. She was all in. That was one of the weaknesses of hers. She did not have breaks. She would overwork to the point of exhaustion, to the point of being hospitalized for the exhaustion. She would just give too much of herself away. And that's notable too, because that was a weakness of hers. And she ended up developing a pretty significant heart problem after having some surge. She was put in the hospital because of this exhaustion. She got to this point of just not being able to do it anymore, working so hard. And she had minor surgery. And when she woke up, she had this heart problem. All of a sudden it kind of developed. They don't know why. They don't know how it happened, but it was also the 1800s, so probably happened a lot. I think about it. But as I was thinking about her life today, actually, it seems as though it was God's grace to her, because that seemed to be a struggle for the rest of her life to put the brakes on when she needed to stop when she needed to rest when she needed to rest. And I don't know if you guys remember, but one of the books that was recommended through Humble Roots was C.J. Mahaney's Humility book. And he talks about sleep and how it is a gift. And it's God's, it's God's gift to us, and recognizing our limitations is an act of humility, and that embracing sleep as the gift that it is important, you know. And she would say at the end of her life that that was, again, that was a weakness that she had, but God turned this heart problem, I think, into, it redeemed it in a way, because it forced her to rest when she probably wouldn't have otherwise. So she had different periods of time of respite kind of built into her ministry, that she had to stop doing what she was doing and take several weeks, several months of a break, which might look like a sabbatical for other missionaries or coming back. What's that called? A furlough, yeah. So she had those forced on her. She had to take furloughs, which was interesting to me. So that was in 1884 when she figured out that she had this heart problem. And let's see. And it wasn't until 11 years after that choice that was posed to her about art versus this ministry that God had given her, that she felt this call to become a missionary. Initially, she was not interested in doing missions. It was actually kind of a sexy thing to do at the time. You're familiar with different ministries that are like that now, that lots of people seem to jump on, you know, we're going to all do this one thing now. This is a very popular thing to do. And that was what missions had sort of become in England amongst her class of people. So there were lots of people that were being sent different places, and she just wasn't really interested in that. So it wasn't until about 10 years after she kind of made that choice that the Lord started putting on her heart missions, becoming a missionary specifically to North Africa. And she was in a meeting, a missions meeting that she was in. And it was at the end of it that someone said, is God calling anyone here to North Africa? The meeting was composed of people who were ministering at that time in North Africa, particularly in Algeria. And she stood up and said, "He's calling me." Just straight up, didn't hesitate, no hesitation, "He's calling me." And she applied to the North African mission the next week. It was very quick, applied, and she was rejected right away because of her heart condition. And that did not stop her, because she was a woman of means. She did not need to be financially supported by anyone. So she supported herself. And two other single women went with her that were also of means, and they just supported themselves. And they went in cooperation with the North African mission. Like, they had an understanding between the two of them that you're not technically one of ours because you can't pass our exams, but we are going to kind of work together with you. You're not going in opposition to us. We support this idea, you know, this venture of yours. So, and then they left. Within like a few months, they left, and they moved to Algeria. And I wish I had a map of where Algeria is, if you guys aren't familiar. But it's between Morocco and where else? Anybody? Huh?
Libya.
Yeah, Egypt. Yeah, Libya. Yeah, there you go.
Algeria, Libya, Egypt.
Algeria, Libya. Yeah, that's right. I didn't really know. I wasn't like, I really didn't know. That's why I was asking you guys to tell me. I couldn't remember. Six babies. So at least I'll blame it on six babies. So they moved to Algeria, and they had no experience. They had not one sentence of Arabic. They had knew nothing. They had no concept of the culture. They had no concept of Islam and how it impacted every facet of life. They just had really nothing to go on, and they went anyway. And some would say they were described as clueless, and they were. They were absolutely clueless, and their diaries said as much. We are clueless. We have no idea what we're doing. She actually said, if God wants weakness, he has it, because we have nothing to offer these people, other than we know that we're supposed to be here. So they took to learning Arabic very quickly, and they said that they would only study when they were very tired, because it was very restful to them, which is just bizarre to me, crazy to me. Like, learned Arabic because it was restful to them. We watched Netflix, they learned Arabic. Interestingly enough. And they got a tutor, a young boy, tutored them, and he was in awe of their inability to, because they didn't know anything. So he was even struck by, why did these three English women, single women, in the late 1800s go into the middle of, they moved into the slums of a city in Algeria to start their ministry. It's just where they moved directly. And that's just, anyway, it's just interesting. That wouldn't happen today. We wouldn't send three single women into Algeria. Unless you know something I don't know. I'm pretty sure we wouldn't let that happen. But it was something similar to what she did in London. And she did the... She wasn't necessarily prone to doing dangerous things or risky things. She wasn't described that way. But she definitely did those things. Pushed against the norm, definitely. Let's see. So they started trying to meet people. That looked like mostly men because the women were sort of sequestered in their homes. We're more familiar with Islam now than really any Protestants in history, probably, which is interesting because most people in Europe didn't know really how much Islam would impact the culture in Africa, this part of Africa anyway. So they began to teach Bible studies, inviting people to the Bible studies. It was mostly men that would show up, which is interesting too. To the end, reading, I had to reread. I'm like, really? Muslim men would show up to these Bible studies? But they did, and they didn't see a convert for 3 years. And that was when it really struck them how serious it was for someone to convert from Islam, because he showed up at their doorstep bloodied, beat up, because men had just tore him apart, basically, because he had professed faith. And that's when they ultimately decided to stay where they were, seeing the great need. Ultimately, the goal was to reach the women there, knowing that that was the only way to reach the women in Algeria was by a woman. They knew that. And so they knew there had to be women there in order to minister to these women that are in these homes. They quickly found that if they reached out to the children, that they would gain access to the women. It took a while, but they slowly started gaining access to the women that way, which is interesting. And that's the kind of the way that we do it now, too, gaining access through children. We do it with VBS, right? Bring your kids, and hopefully we gain access to your parents as well. It was said of her, so she ministered in Africa for 40 years, and up until she died, she was bedridden at the end of her life, but up until a few years before she passed away, that's where she was, and she had a real just a love for the people that she was ministering to and evangelizing. And it was said that the methods and the means that she developed to evangelize were 100 years ahead of her time. If you ever have taken a missiology class or just different ways that we have evangelized over the course of church history, it's changed. And there's different methods that we've used and different methods that different denominations have used, those kinds of things. And the things that she employed on her own that she kind of came up with these women to bring the gospel to these people were light years ahead of her time, of their time, that we still use now. Her ministry became the United Arab, sorry, I want to make sure that I get it right. The Algiers Mission Band is what it was called. Are you familiar with that at all, Cherry? No. By the end, they had established 15 preaching stations throughout the area. There was some mountainous regions across the desert, and that was really where her heart was. She saw, when she moved to Algeria, it says she saw the desert and she saw the mountains, and that's where she wanted to go because no one had gone there before. And she just had a heart for those people. And she didn't know that those people, she just knew that there were Arabs that lived there and that they didn't have the gospel, and she wanted to take it to them. And so as soon as she had sort of established this base in northern Algeria, in the slums there, They had more people had joined them at this point, more workers had joined them. As soon as that was kind of established, she up and left with one of her colleagues. Her name was Helen. It was Helen and Blanche and her that were all three together, these three single women. And Blanche. Anyway, so Helen and her got up and they decided they were going to make the trek across the Sahara. Does that make sense? Right? It was like 450 miles or something crazy of desert. And it was considered a very dangerous journey. It's considered, men did not make the journey because it was considered so dangerous. They had a guide, and they said of the guide that he probably also needed a guide. And they said it sort of jokingly, which, because they just had faith that the Lord would bring them to the other side if they were supposed to get there. But they would joke about him that he was prone to drinking and fits of rage, is what they said, and that he probably needed a guide himself. And they rode camels across the desert to get to the people that lived in the mountains across the way. And they did that. She would go and visit, and then they would come back again. And she would take forced periods of respite back in England whenever her health complications would arise. It was a very harsh climate, and so missionaries that would come over, they would leave or die, and then they would have to leave because, or, you know, they come over as a family, and maybe one of them would pass away, and then they would leave. It was just a very harsh climate, and then the culture alone also was just very harsh as well. And so she would make lots of different trips into the surrounding region. And loved it. Just talked about how beautiful it was and what a gift it was. And people that look back on her life, you know, questioning, I would imagine mostly non-believers or critics saying, well, why would you give this opportunity up for, you know, fame or to really perfect the gift that you've been given, this talent that you've been given. And at the end of her life, she said, oh, how good God was that he let her live out her life in the most beautiful place on earth. Because she had this eye for beauty. And I just thought that was fairly, really neat and interesting that God did that. And I think he does that for us too, if we give ourselves to him. Nothing is wasted in the kingdom of God. And he has given us all very unique giftings. And when given to the Lord is when they are perfected. And that was very encouraging to learn about, I think. So the way that she did evangelism and ministry was house by house, person by person, loving people. Super basic, but it wasn't apparently very basic. But that is the way into, that was the way into their lives. That was the way into the women's homes. The women there, I know a lot of us, again, we know more about the culture of Islam now than maybe we ever have, but they would, you know, birth children and then they would be rejected for younger women once, you know, the girls were of marrying age around 11 or 12. They would, you know, birth the children and they would kind of be rejected and pushed to the side, but they couldn't remarry necessarily. And so she would teach them how to do different trades, like weaving, just different types of things that they could do to kind of help support one another. There's different ministries now that do that, right? That go and employ women. And she was doing it much earlier than that. And she had, the means and the ability to do it. It was kind of a women empowering book to read, you know, especially when... So she was compelled to lead this ministry, and she was very reluctant to do so because she knew how much pushback she would get because there were men in the ministry as well that were becoming a part of this ministry that she was kind of building. And so she was very reluctant to take any leadership in that space. And so what she did was she did it sort of in name only and just very shrewdly tried to highlight the men's leadership skills around her and allowing them to take roles that she could have taken, and she just chose not to. And that she did that on her own. Was not necessarily encouraged to do that, but did that, and that was interesting and encouraging too. Just time after time after time, just kind of step back and let other people be the front, at the forefront of the ministry. So, and again, we wouldn't even know about her at all if someone hadn't dug all of her information up and read all of her diaries and then decided to write a story about her, which was encouraging too. She still had an interaction with John Ruskin until he died, and again, he thought she was wasting her gift. He would say that the colors of her paintings that she would send were getting muted and were being ruined by the climate that she was a part of, or that she was around, and maybe that was true. Again, I can't click through the pictures again. Make one of you guys do it. Would you do it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Click through some of them. And they did. The color definitely showed, you know, that she was in a different area and that her art was taking on kind of a different form, maybe.
Okay.
Oh. Leah asked, what did her parents think about this? So that's actually really interesting. She did not leave the country until her mother had died. Doesn't really tell why. You could speculate why that might be. But she didn't leave, and her father was already died. And then she waited until after her mother had died.
How old was she when she went down?
27? No. That was when she met John. She was 34. She was 34. I remember because I will be 34, and I remembered. Keeping it in mind.
Particular order, just when I flip.
No, yeah, they're not in any really particular order. They're just pieces of art. So one of the books that she wrote, and I hesitate to call it a book because it's 23 pages, but it is a book. If I wrote it, I would call it a book, for sure. But it's called The Parables of the Cross, and she wrote another one called The Parables of the Christ Life. And they're parables, they're pictures of the Christian life that she saw in nature. So similarly to Hannah Anderson, who took the idea of gardening and attributed a lot of the walk of a Christian life and sanctification to gardening, she did the same thing in things that she observed in nature with plants and seeds and plants going to seed and giving all of themselves to be made into something more beautiful, and giving themselves up to what they were made for, what they were created for. So that was interesting too. It's definitely very poetic, flowery language, but really rich too. Really, really great. And short, which is also really great. And really good as like a devotional, if you wanted to like an accompaniment to something that maybe you're studying. But one of the things she could see, you know, in nature, are these pictures of the Christian life, and these pictures that were so encouraging, she would write them down. And John Ruskin said one thing that he's known for saying, or famously said, I'm gonna make sure that I get it exactly right, if I can. Let's see. I'm probably not going to. I'm not gonna get it right exactly. But for every 100 speakers, there is one thinker, and for thousands of thinkers, there's one who can see. And he was suggesting that she could see things that others could not see. I think he probably would have counted himself as a seer also. But that became particularly important because when she was ministering to the Muslims in Algeria, there were a lot of mystics that she came across within the faith. And one group in particular was called the Sufi sect, am I pronouncing that correctly, of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were the mystics, they were like the Sufi Mystic Brotherhood, I think is what they were called. And they invited her into like their inner circle to learn from her. And they could relate to her because she was artistic and she could see things, or the way that she talked about the world was what they could understand. They could understand it. I thought it was just fascinating, you know, one, that she had an audience of these Muslim men invited her into this space that was not, women were not allowed to be in, and that she wasn't attacked physically, you know. I think you had asked, was she raped? No, you know, shockingly not. You know, she would travel across the Sahara Desert over and over again and was not harmed at all. And she was quite good looking, I thought, when I saw the picture of her. She was beautiful. Anyway, so she had a knack for combining text and art together. And so that was like what her journal pages would look like. She would paint something and then she'd write around it. And it was really just for herself. Not thinking, you know, you don't think, well, I sure hope nobody's reading my journals. 100 years from now, I have agreements with friends. They are going to burn my journals. So I'm very serious about that. I have several friends that's the agreement that we've made. Anyway, so I'm pretty sure she didn't think anybody was going to be looking at her journals. But she had this ability to see beautiful things, and which is interesting. So there's a documentary about her as well. It's called Many Beautiful Things. And it's only an hour. You rent it on Amazon Prime. It's really interesting.
Is it appropriate?
It is, yeah. Okay. It's very appropriate.
I
mean,
I don't know why it wouldn't be.
It is. Now, for you, No, it is. It's appropriate. It's just that it doesn't, honestly, I think it does a poor job of highlighting Jesus, in my opinion, just because it's a made-for-TV documentary. You know, it definitely talks about her faith, but it's very generalized, you know, that her faith is what compelled her to go, because you really can't get away from that, you know. Why would she go? And so it talks about that, but it doesn't really talk about her love for Christ, that being the reason why she left her home. So I'm going to flip through a couple of those, and let's see.
Is that from her journal?
Uh-huh. Well, one of the pictures is. Someone put some text over it, but that is a quote from her. It's actually on your page. Something that she said is, holiness, not safety, is the end of our calling. I think as women, we can relate to that. We often want to preserve our life or the lives of our children or the lives of our families. And one of her life's mantras was that the Lord shapes us, fashions us, and it's through hardship, it's through suffering, often through death. You're constant dying to yourself. And again, this picture of the plants going to seed. We were talking about how coriander is cilantro in different parts of the world. It's the same thing. But once it goes to seed, you know, that's what happens to certain flowers. They go back to seed and they become something more beautiful. And it's just constant death after death after death after death. And it's made new again. And that's what the Christian life is like. There's a constant dying to ourselves. Her life was very interesting, and I highly recommend reading more about her. But I gave you guys a handout. Any questions about that?
The picture of John Ruskin's house, did she paint it?
No, this is a photograph.
That's a photograph?
Mm-hmm. It's still there, so the house is, like, preserved.
Oh. It's sort of like the end of her life.
So she was pretty sick at the end of her life, and she was bedridden. And so she would sketch. Her eyesight kind of went away a little bit, and then she died. But she ministered in Africa until the end of her life.
How old was she?
I don't know. She was, 1928. 72, 73?
Mid-70s. Did she die back in England?
I don't know. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Why did she cross the Sahara Desert? You said she crossed the Sahara Desert, right?
Yeah.
Two other women? Is that just for ministry?
Yeah, for ministry.
People living in the desert?
Yeah, and on the other side. I guess there were, like, mountainous regions on the other side, and so she wanted to get to that area. And definitely no English-speaking woman had made their way across, but then it was definitely an unreached area.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, so on your handout, so one of the headings in her book is that death is the gate of life. I was talking with Clayton about this, interestingly enough, as we were talking about suffering and they, like, preach on suffering. It was not planned. but what a mark of the Christian life that is walking through death after death after death. And she saw everything that she had been given as a potential offering to the Lord. Even her artistic endeavors, everything, as an offering, as a potential offering to the Lord. And she said, I thought this was a really great quote, Are all things, even the treasures that he has sanctified, held loosely, ready to be parted with, without a struggle, when he asks for them? For the blessedness of receiving is not all that God has for us. A new world lies beyond, a world of giving, a giving first to God in surrender, then to man in sacrifice. And we ourselves are saved to save. We are made to give, to let everything go, if only we may have more to give. And the reason I picked that is, as I was, you know, reading about this woman's life and how she just constantly give of herself over and over and over again, and really this Parables of the Cross book is pretty excellent. It's pretty great. Just we live in a culture that doesn't tell us to do that. It definitely is. It's pretty popular nowadays to make sure that you save enough of yourself back, keep enough of yourself back, so that. Now, it's said so that you can serve others well, right? But that is still very much in opposition to what Scripture tells us to do. We're not supposed to reserve any of ourselves. We're supposed to completely die to ourselves. There's a list of Scriptures on there, and that first kind of grouping, there's a lot of them. We don't have to go through all of them. But I just encourage you to kind of read through those if you have time. And then that first blank on there, I also sort of panicked when I thought, oh, I should have a handout for this. And I do. I'm like, what am I going to put on there? And Clayton said, just put a couple things with some blanks. That's what he said. And I didn't plan on saying that to you until just now. But I'm not saying that's what he does. But it might be what he does. No, but the only way to let everything go so that we may have more to give is through death. I don't know if any of those are familiar passages to you, but I'll flip to a couple of them. Let's see. Did you already get through all of those? Probably.
Do you have more to the right?
No. Oh, maybe. No.
Past this?
Maybe. Yeah, I think so. No, I don't think so. I don't think there are. I don't think there are anymore. Okay, so I'm actually not going to go through and read several. I don't think I'm going to be able to flip through. And then that second part, holiness, not safety, is the end of our calling. And then the need for total abandonment to God's purpose is the call for every Christian. That is, again, kind of a major theme within her life, was the call of total abandonment. So she would have said that her choice to not pursue art, again, was not prescriptive. She wouldn't say that that's required of every believer to lay down these God-given gifts and talents that you've been given. But she will say that it's an absolute requirement of every Christian to completely abandon yourself to the Lord. And that if you don't, then you're missing out. Essentially, which I think is true. I think we'd all attest to that. I think, too, our culture now is pretty focused on uniqueness and people wanting to find their identity in something. That's not really new, but the number of personality tests that we have now are, crazy. Enneagram test, anybody? Here's your number 1 through 9. I'm pretty sure God created more people than, there's more than 9 of us, right? Even with all the wings, there's still more combinations of people. But yet we, flock to those things. And we want to identify with something, if only to be able to justify our faults, right? To be able to justify our sin to other people. And I just think it's interesting because our call as believers is to lay those things down, our life completely down, to put to death the old man, to put on the new man that looks like Christ. And that doesn't, it's not to say that we are not unique, but our uniqueness is found in our abandonment to Christ. And that it's perfectly glorified when we do that in him. And until we do, missing a very key component. So he made us all very unique people, which is a beautiful thing, or made in his image, with unique gifts and talents. But finding our identity in the way that the world would try to describe those gifts and talents is really empty, and really misses a key to his design, I think, in the way that he's, in the different callings that he's placed on our life. I think, too, are, you know, I have six children, and some of you don't have any children. Some of you are in the workplace. Some of you have two. Some of you have grandchildren, you know. He's gifted us each uniquely to be able to mother, be a grandmother, to work in those places, to give ourselves fully to those things that he's called us to in unique ways, and to not seek our wisdom from the world that would tell us how to do it, but to seek our wisdom from his word in how to do it. And anyway, I've just been encouraged by that in my own mothering through this, that he's given me unique giftings that someone else doesn't have, that I can pass on to my children through the power of the gospel in me, and that only I can do that through the power of the Holy Spirit. No one else can do it better. And as we're trying, you know, Mother's Day just happened, right? And we want to build one another up. Always, you shame the mom guilt shamers. I don't know if you call it that. Put it that way. But everyone wants to build one another up and saying, you're enough. You are, you're good enough. When the reality is, we know as believers, we're not. We're absolutely not good enough. And there's no way we're going to be good enough, except through Christ. He is enough. And the way that he's made us, our unique abilities are perfected through that. When we say, I am not enough, but he is, and he makes me unique and perfectly suited for this task that he's given me. Which is just really encouraging to me as a believer. And then I was thinking about it and thinking that humility is recognizing without complaint that God himself gets to decide how he uses the vessels that he has created, however he chooses. I think the world would have said that Lilius's gifts would have been better used in a different way. When God clearly used all of her gifts in this amazingly glorious, beautiful way, and she wasn't lacking anything. She got to live in this part of the world that she was blown away by. And then afterwards, her life was preserved, or her legacy was preserved in this way, and her art too. I have on there, we've been freed to be fueled by Christ and his word. And the reason I put that on there is I was talking with my dad this weekend, and we were talking about the personality test idea. What fuels you, right? Like, are you fueled by people, or are you fueled by time alone? Are you an introvert, or are you an extrovert? Are you an extroverted introvert? Are you an introverted introvert? You know, I don't really know how, why there's so many different categories, but there are, and it's all like, what fuels you? What fuels you? I think the gospel frees us to all be fueled by the same thing. We are fueled by him and by his word. And we can deny the other things, part of the old man, and choose to be fueled by the same thing and encourage one another in that. I don't think that we have the option of being introverted as Christians. I don't think we have the freedom to be introverted in that way. Not in the way that maybe the world would say that we, you know, we do. It might be my baby needing to nurse. I don't know. Anyway, so let's see. It is lost to keep when... let's see. It is lost to keep when God says give. And then on the back, this is one of her big illustrations that she would use pretty regularly about a dandelion. So the dandelion has long ago surrendered its golden petals and has reached its crowning stage of dying, which actually made me think of scripture that we will receive a crown of glory the end of all things. A delicate seed globe must break up now. It gives and gives till it has nothing left. What a revolution would come over the world of starving bodies at home, the world of starving souls abroad, if something like this were the standard of giving. If God's people ventured on making themselves poor as Jesus did for the sake of the need around. If the I, me, mine were practically delivered up, no longer to be recognized when they clash with those needs.
You missed two.
Yeah, you missed
you. I missed you? Yeah. Sorry. Again, randomly picking blanks is not the way to go.
The second one on the bottom.
Our uniqueness is not swallowed up by self-denial for the sake of Christ. Rather, our uniqueness is gloriously perfected through such sacrifice.
Through such what?
Sacrifice.
And then Christ,
and now his dreams.
His dreams.
Yeah. In a world that says pursue your dreams, I'm speaking specifically to moms here. Don't lose yourself to motherhood. Don't lose yourself to wifing or whatever you've been called to. When that's the opposite, I don't know, wifing, sure. When that's what we've been called to. We've been called to lose ourselves to Christ, to what he's called us to our callings. And if our identity is rooted in him, then we're not going to wake up one day when our kids are out of the house and wonder, oh no, what am I going to do with my life? Not if our identity is wrapped up in Christ. So, okay. That's all. I have to go. Sorry.